Hi everyone, Bread and Goods is sponsored by Works in Progress, the online magazine. I really enjoy reading Works in Progress, and my favorite piece of theirs has been The Housing Theory of Everything. In the piece, the authors provide astounding evidence for why a huge swath of our social ills are caused by our inability to build more housing. It's a pretty mind-blowing piece if you've never read it. You can find their works online on worksinprogress.co. The link is in the show notes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Bread and Goods podcast. I'm speaking to Derek Wong, who is a portfolio manager at Sing Alliance. Now, before we start the podcast, I'd like to say that nothing on this podcast is financial advice, and all of these are mine and Derek's personal opinions. This podcast isn't to encourage or promote taking risks or any trades or investments. Any information here is for informational purposes and is not financial advice. And nothing in this conversation should be understood as a recommendation to buy, sell, or perform any other activities in financial markets. Please conduct a financial advisor. But here is some life advice. Don't get financial advice from people you don't know. So hi, Derek. Nice to have you on.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. So, something to my listeners is that I first heard Derek talk at my university's investing society, and he talked about a very interesting topic, which is that conventionally in finance classes, they'll teach you that the market is, quote unquote, efficient, and you have these levels of efficiency. But as you think more about it, that's not always true. And Derek introduced us to the idea of the market as a complex adaptive system. So Derek, could you explain that concept a little?
Sure. Simply, a complex adaptive system is something that you see more in science and nature. You could think of it as a network of ants building an anthill, lots of individual parts or agents in terms interact with each other to create a larger ecosystem, but also effects. And this is what we see in the markets, as every participant could be considered a little ant. Some ants are bigger than others, a queen ant or a soldier ant. They have different roles, and how they interact to create the entire financial system or the entire financial universe is, I think, a more comprehensive way of understanding the financial markets. Because if you think about the efficient market hypothesis, we shouldn't have fat tails, and we know absolutely these things occur. But using complex adaptive systems mental model, we are able to explain how those fat tails and shock events happen more frequently than they should by a normal statistical measure.
And so, according to this idea, how should investors look differently at the market when compared to the EMH?
Well, first of all, if this nonlinearity or these fat tails occur, in parlance of complex adaptive systems, it's called emergence. It means it's something that can be captured. Some classical people who have been capturing it for a long time are trend followers. They know that these things exist. They know they are able to capture these outsized moves. And that is one of the longest historied, say, quantitative or systematic strategies that are out there and still exist today and have not, been distorted so much. There are a lot of people out there that continue to use these classical methods.
And why do these fat tails happen? Because we usually assume in finance that these events are normally distributed. But, famously, for example, in the great financial crisis, I remember Goldman spokesperson, I read about them saying that, hey, this is a 27 sigma event. It can only happen in once every so many million years. But if this happens once in so many, so many times, if some event that's supposed to happen only once in 7 million years happens once, your model is probably wrong. So why do these fat tails happen?
Right. And I will go back to this anthill model. We have different participants in the markets who have different jobs. They all have different risk tolerances, and they all have different objectives. Everyone is trying to get something out of the market, whether it's a pension fund trying to match their liabilities, a hedge fund trying to generate alpha for their clients, your retail investor trying to invest for the retirement, they all have these different limits. And they can create feedback loops on each other. And I think this is the most important part. These feedback loops, one of them being the example of, say, the GameStop on Reddit, comes from this social aspect of the financial markets. And I don't think that part is studied. Your action will have impact on me. And this can be especially true during downside shocks, which is why we see correlations 10 to 1 during that, because people are forced to do something. So one, you should know your counterparties, right? You should know who's interacting as agents in this network. And two, if you can figure out what their limits are, then it will have to force them to do something. And downside shocks tend to force liquidations. Whether it's in the crypto markets or the traditional markets, it doesn't matter. Everyone has a fixed amount of capital that they can keep putting into an investment before they have to close it. And then that will feed on itself. One person's liquidation means they have to sell it at a worse price, which forces the next person below them also has to sell. And this chain reaction is something that first is not covered in the efficient market hypothesis, but it's something we see in everyday life. We see it, whether it's viral videos being passed around, memes, or why wouldn't that occur in the financial markets when we are all humans going to get our objective through this mechanism of network of the financial networks.
Yeah, and you know, we sometimes assume that this happens because market participants are unsophisticated and wrong, but many times it happens even the most sophisticated part of markets, like during COVID when the Treasury market was you know, it went haywire for a few days, and then this is supposedly the part where the smart money's in, and even then they had to there was forced selling because of you know, margin calls and so on. And and somebody who is, you know, more traditionally focused might hear us talking and say, yeah, this sounds very nice, the ideas are cool, but how do I implement this in practice? How does you know, how do you talk to investors about that?
Well, I think one way to think about it is looking at market fragility. Certain participants will be more fragile than others. And taking this liquidation aid example, whether it's in the fixed income market, ties back into the previous example I mentioned. If certain participants are poorly capitalized, if liquidity has been tight, it will tend to have easier ability to knock the market out of, quote, equilibrium. But markets are never actually in equilibrium. They're in a constant state of flux that is moving around some kind of local minimum or maximum. And it could take a nudge or it could take a shock. And determining the fragility of the overall market will help you determine if it's a nudge or a shock that takes it to push it over the edge. And that is how you can create something actionable. And if you are someone who's, say, very focused on a specific equity sector, you can look at that sector. Are people well capitalized or not? That will also work. You can take this, you know, all the way down to, is this individual company, is this individual fund capturing this type of thing? Is it robust to this type of thing? Is it anti-fragile to this type of thing? If it's anti-fragile, they will profit from it. So then that will assist in the decorrelated returns you want to get. So that is how you can identify opportunity by using this mental framework. The question is, how do you identify this fragility and how do you classify that and how do you figure out where you are?
Do you have any examples of trades you've made in the past that use this sort of thinking?
Yes. One of the proprietary strategies that we have in my fund is to use this idea of market fragility and to have it enhance our hedging portfolio. So when we know that there is increased market fragility or instability in the markets, or that things that should be diversifying each other are starting to not diversify each other, that's a hint. Then that will tend for us to mean that we are now magnifying our risk. We are in effect getting leverage on our position because these things are moving closer and closer together. So we should be reducing the risks of this specific part of our portfolio or the entire portfolio, to remove that or to immunize ourselves from that. And so that will help you deal with, say, your hedging ratio, right? That should augment your hedging ratio. If you were just using, say, like the beta as your hedging ratio, it would be not enough. You would be under-hedged. And so that is a way that it is implemented in practice.
And like globally, does this work the same everywhere around the world, you know, even excluding China? Is the principle?
Oh, it works in China.
Oh, it works. Okay.
It works everywhere. the thing is, the people don't change. The network doesn't change. The agents in the network change. Their fragility or anti-fragility and where their local minima or maxima is changes. But the nudge or the shock will occur in every market. And then how robust is that market at any given time to that push? So specifically in China or emerging markets, this tends to work a lot better because systems are a lot less robust. If you compare that to, say, like post-MiFID III, post-GFC, US and Europe tend to be quite more robust to these types of things, which is why we can be in the soft landing situation we are now, where only small regional banks blow up in the US and it doesn't have a cascading effect. So that prevented the feedback loop, right? But if you're in an emerging economy that doesn't have such strong history of institutions and quick, say, legislation to be able to prevent these types of things, or say the capital, and they have to go to the World Bank to get a loan to fund this thing, you're in a totally different position. So the amount of fragility and the knock-on effect, the cascade effect is what you want to capture. And so that cascade effect could be larger in, say, less robust marketplaces or more emerging marketplaces that don't have these institutional safeguards in place.
So do you hedge more? Do you just put lesser exposure into these markets? How does your strategy differ when you're like, you know, when you invest in Chinese markets versus the West?
If I were to invest differently, actually, I take a market agnostic approach because I'm trying to capture these things that apply to all markets. But I don't think that's the case for most investors. I used to work in China. I worked in Beijing for the asset management arm of a large metals company. And then again, as the one of the first 3PMs, the arm of a Shanghai listed commodity company's asset management arm. The thing is, I worked in the Beijing side, not the Shanghai side. And there's a really big difference between Beijing investment and Shanghai investment. And what you see is that I would say Shanghai or your Hong Kongs are much more like a New York or a London style, say, investment strategies, while the Beijing is more political. And if I were to just focus on China, I would focus on that just because I understand how important the relationships are. Public information is basically useless. You need to be capturing something that is like repeatable, which is why this kind of fragility or these feedback loops or things that cause trends or cascade effects, it doesn't matter what causes it. We're not looking for the causal relation. We're looking for the outcome, and able to capture that is what we do now. But other people, I think, are trying to trade China from outside of China, and that just does not work. I wouldn't suggest that to anybody.
Like when you invested there, so you focus mostly on gaining non-public information. Like I didn't fully understand that.
I know it sounds like insider trading, right? In commodities, I mean, there's no such thing as insider. The thing is, it's like the way the Chinese market works, it's policy driven. Policy is created by people. Knowing what policies are going to come out because you have dinner with them in the private government canteens is a plus, because I will know days to weeks in advance before something is happening, right? How you could deal with that if you've got a Bloomberg and a Reuters if you're sitting in Hong Kong is like impossible. Shanghai people have a much closer relationship because they probably have some Beijing entity that is feeding them this information as well. There are a lot of structural advantages to investing in China and being Chinese. These create large economic moats that competitors cannot replicate because they don't have the right relationships. For example, one of the ones that we did have was a very large US dollar line through SAFE. Because we were a commodity company, we actually had physical commodities trading through. So the government allocated us a large budget every year. As long as we remitted at the end of the year all of those dollars back to China, it would refresh the next year. So we were able to do arbitrages between metals in China, LME, and the US, which other people were not able to do just because they aren't able to do enough size or get approved by SAFE at all. So these structural advantages come from knowing the people and this kind of thing. I know it sounds harsh, but I really do think that's how the Chinese market works.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You used to work at the CBOT before, like, and back when it still had physical trading. I saw it on a separate podcast of yours. What was that like?
Well, I mean, I started as a lowly runner in my teenage years, actually, at the Chicago Board of Trade, running in wheat, corn, soybeans, and rough rice for some locals. And it was a very visceral experience. When you actually see the market change because orders are coming in, the fury, and then the changing on the board.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, we just had these really large tablets that allowed us to arb between the electronic markets and the paper markets, and then we were filling orders over the phone. That was basically the business model, taking the flow. Mm-hmm. You can actually see, first of all, who's your competitor. You can see the other people out trying to outbid you or trying to out get filled by you. You can see that this counterparty is really important because maybe they're bigger than you, like physically bigger. People can see them flash their price and get filled faster than you. You know, they can yell louder than you, and that's a problem, like or an advantage. You know, and how that really instilled in my mind, first of all, there is another person on the side of this trade. They're trying to get edge on you. What can I do to prevent that from happening to me, or still have enough spread left over between me and my client that I can accept the amount of haircut he's giving me, right?
Yeah.
And everyone carried their limit order books in their chest pockets. So you know that they have things to do. There is a strategy behind what they're doing, and no one is dumb. Everyone has their own objective. And it depends on which clients they have. And that, I think, is really lost now. And that really informs my style of trading now, even though I'm a completely systematic quant trading. I still always think about the counterparty. And I think that that's probably why I like the complex adaptive system, because it requires agents. It requires people to be doing it, because I know in the end, no matter how large your institution, you're coming into the pit to be filled. Some person is there fighting for you. They're your champion, and they're going to be going against the market who is trying to take an edge on you to get what you want.
So how did you study computer science or math in college? How do you make the transition from that to systematic trading?
Yeah, I mean, I did study engineering and computer science. People were transitioning from the floor to the screen because it was dying. And so being able to code back then was a much rarer skill. I mean, back in the day, I studied C++. So that's what we had to learn on. We were writing our exam papers, code papers, with pencil.
Oh,
and
no,
had to debug.
I did that. I wrote an exam, exactly the same thing.
I thought that was like, we've gone beyond that. You can use the compiler now. And Python was just coming on the scene. It was, you know, slightly after that. And yeah, there was a big transition. You had a lot of people trading, trying to replicate the strategies onto the screen, and a lot of locals died doing that. Other people were able to diversify out into other areas, whether that to be much more longer term, because their edge might have been they're really good at reading the pit. They're good at reading the sentiment. They can feel when certain types of orders are coming into the market because of reading people's poker face. that was gone for them, and then they died. So they either needed to diversify into other kind of strategies, whether it be like automated market making or longer term strategies, like I had mentioned, trend following or carry or these other types of things. And that really taught me, like, first of all, we all had that experience, but then like how to be adaptive in this world and like how to start to get into this, because I don't have the financial background. I just came into it as like very much from the practitioner point of view, which is why I think I'm not brainwashed with the traditional financial education, but it also means I'm quite out there. I'm definitely the black sheep when I sit down with other financial professionals.
Yeah, I mean, so one of these things I've noticed in finance is that, like, you take a separate industry and somebody says a new technology is coming, and broadly, you would expect that the main participants in that industry do better because of that new technology. You know, some of them obviously fail, but finance, especially trading, because of the zero sum nature, means that in general, better technology means that more people fail than succeed. How do you deal with that? And I don't think it's like, one example was the move from paper to computers. Another one might well be the amount of amazing generative AI search tools we have these days. Like, I'm pretty sure Bloomberg released their Bloomberg GPT, I don't know, 6 months ago, where you could pretty much natural language search through filings, and Bloomberg is the natural company to do that. And I feel like, over time, you would expect the profit pool to reduce because of these new technologies. How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, you said it was a zero-sum game. No, it's worse than that. It's a negative-sum game because you can't trade for free.
Yeah, fair.
I think the problem that you're explaining really comes from one thing, is that the barrier to entry is much lower. I mean, before, like when we're talking about when I was working in the pits, is that we did charts in the morning, like by hand or printed from a dot matrix printer. Okay. Like, that's fine. I mean, okay. I am not that old. It was the end of it, but it's still quite interesting because this one thing is what you're taking out, or like you just update your Greek sheets at lunch, when it gets quiet, like that's your refresh. You get one refresh, Now with data being so prominent, the hurdle rate is lower. So a lot more people are trying. Before, you needed at least a few hundred K, we'll say, to try your hand at it. You would need to buy a seat on the board of trade. So that would cost you probably 50 to 100 K just to play. So just to even get a seat at the table, you would probably need $500,000 to $1 million, and $500,000, you're probably cutting it tight. You're going to need to make profit the first month. That is not the case now. You can open at any discount broker. You can fund with $10,000 and you can go for it. And you can like plug in your Python API and try everything and smash everything. And so you're going to get a lot more failures. I think the people who were trying back then were a lot more serious as well. Like if you're putting that amount of money on the line, your life savings, you're going to do your best to figure out how to make it happen. But if it's only like a few $1,000s or like a few months of work, or I don't know, whatever, then you're not going to be as driven to do it. And I do think that this skill sets, it's a skill set. It's a craft. Mm-hmm. Getting money out of the market is a craft. Creating portfolios is a craft. It can be learned. It can be taught. But it takes grit and a lot of psychological strengths, because it wearing risk deals a lot of emotional and psychological damage. And if you don't have the right attitude to it, and you come home and are angry with your family because you screwed up during the day, it can really destroy your life.
And like, tell me more about it, because everyone tells that, Warren Buffett famously says you need temperament and IQ you can deal with later. What is that sort of psychological makeup you need to do this well?
Well, I think that compartmentalization is important. Self-reflection. You need to be able to compartmentalize the stress from the day to coming home. I mentioned maybe something big happened to my wife, but it's never with emotional content. It's just that they ask, how did your day go? Well, it was a bit screwed up, but like, hey, let's have dinner, let's watch a movie or some shows with the kids or sing some songs or whatever, read some stories. It's fine. I do want to put something out there. Psychology doesn't make you profitable. So like there's a lot of people on the internet talking to retail people that say like, oh, you just fix your psychology, you're going to make money. Nope. The only way to do that is to have an edge. So if you don't have an edge, don't play. And I think the other part of it is the self-reflection and constant improvement. You need to be looking at yourself and saying like, okay, I need this skill set. I made this mistake and I'm not going to have it happen again. The faster you are at course correction, the less it will cost you because the market will take a tuition from you before you're able to get over the hump. The faster you can figure out what went wrong, the less tuition you have to pay.
Yeah, no, that's fair. On a different note, what sort of strategies do you employ, and do you trade, you know, currencies, bonds, stocks? What's your overall portfolio like?
Well, I run two funds, one systematic global macro and one systematic digital. So in fact, I trade everything. I trade FX, rates and fixed income. I trade commodities. I trade equity indices, metals, energy, like and anything you can think of, emerging markets, equities, not single stocks though. And then on the digital side, yeah, I trade most of the large cryptos and tokens. So again, my strategy is the opposite of the Warren Buffett. I'm a highly diversified, large portfolio kind of person, although these two portfolios are separate. I think that method has worked for me. I like being able to spread my risk out across many things.
So in your traditional macro fund, I can think of, you know, what you do. You investigate correlations between, you know, different asset classes, different assets within those classes, and so like that's pretty well documented. How does crypto systematic work? Because you don't have so many years of data, and even then the regime changes quite more frequently than it does in traditional macro. How do you approach crypto?
No, I think that's a really good insight. The metabolism of crypto is extremely fast. So if you think like the markets move on a daily rate for traditional macro, or maybe even slower than that, because macro news takes a while. It might be monthly or quarterly reports, right? So like say daily to monthly. We would shift that down to hourly or daily in crypto. Again, we go back to these feedback loops. These things also exist in crypto. In fact, again, many years ago, they were much more prominent than they are now because you have a lot bigger players in there who have a lot more robust balance sheets. So you don't see the huge run-ups and the huge crashes. I think examining the crypto market, the maturity of the crypto market and the maturity of the players goes back to our first point of complex adaptive systems and how it can be applied to any market and how you're able to find these edges and capture these things anywhere. So for us, translating, you know, my previous experiences and the strategies you have in the TradFi world, bringing them to the crypto world works, but also specifically targeting crypto native strategies. So like staking doesn't really exist in TradFi, but it is a fixed income instrument. So there's an analogy there, right? So we build analogies that allow us to find these targeted opportunities, right? Options exist, volatility exists, but it's priced slightly differently. I mean, and the marks are different. So you take that, but the theory behind it will be the same. The people behind will be trying probably to do very, very similar things. The only things you don't have, the agents you are missing are central banks and pension funds, right? So you have a lot less long-term robust players in it, which makes it much more spiky tendency, feedback loop tendency.
Yeah. Have you noticed since I think late last year was about the start of the crypto winter, as they call it. Have you noticed more spreads widening, more alpha in the market because of people just losing interest in crypto?
Well, I know in Singapore we have lost quite a few funds. I mean, not the famous news ones, but I mean a lot of people have closed shop.
Mm-hmm.
It was already a small marketplace before, and now maybe 8 or 10 have closed in this crypto winter. The liquidity has dried up, and the competition in the order book has gotten easier. So like that is something like my maker taker ratio has increased for my execution just because there's less people interested in it, but I can do less size. So like it's a trade-off, right? So now I can execute at a better price. I'm getting more maker rates, whether that's a rebate or a reduced commission, rather than, but I can do a lot less of what I was doing before. So I would say it's still worse. I would rather do size. No, because the trade-off has hasn't been equally beneficial. Winning in the order book is not as good as trying to execute all my strategies as full size.
Yeah, no, and like, do you feel that? So, you know, you interact on both the traditional world and the crypto world. Do you feel like, how do you feel that the perception is it going to get better? Because these days, if you ask a pension fund, do you want to invest in crypto? And I'm pretty sure 9 or 10 times out of 10, they'll say, no, we'll wait for some time. But last year, I remember I was at an MRT station, and almost every single ad was crypto, and at that point of time, everybody and everybody was just looking to put more crypto deals. How do you see the perception of the industry changing now?
I mean, it is a winter. This is my second winter, I think. So our clients are not pension funds. They're mostly high net worth, ultra high net worth individuals, family offices. They are much more on the cutting edge than larger institutions or real money like pension funds. It's just not going to be happening anytime soon. Their perception is down, but not out. And one example of that is just how vibrant this last token conference was in Singapore. It was so large compared to the previous one. I think there was over 10,000 people here to do deals. And in the middle of the crypto winter, right? So that sentiment from the crypto side and the people who want to take meetings, like I didn't even attend the conference because there was just so many meetings to take place. And everyone was coming in, whether they were looking for funding or they had new projects or, you know, talking to other funds who have different strategies and reconnecting. I thought that was like a really positive note, much better than I had expected. And talking to other family offices, they are interested, but the allocations will always be small. So it hasn't gone away. And they're just figuring out where to put it. What sleeve does it go into? And that's. I mean, we have assigned it to alternatives, which is why I'm the PM for alternatives, because it does give you a lot of the same attributes that other alternative investments do. But, you know, there is still the hurdle of how do you do it in an institutionalized way? How do you feel comfortable with it? How do you reduce counterparty risk? And I would say I do more of the mundane stuff operating that fund than actually try to come up with new strategies, but keeping it in a nice, clean, audited, regulated bubble is much more of the work and administration than it is like actually trying to come up with something new, which I wish would change because I personally enjoy the research side. That is why I do what I do. But facilitating the business is more important. I can't do what I do if I don't facilitate the business.
You know, for bonds and stocks and to a lesser extent, currencies, there's some sort of fundamental, anchor to the prices, right? You know, if they get like for example, for bonds, you know, if they get too low or from a very, you know, discretionary perspective, you know that in the end you can rely on these cash flows, or for stocks you can count on the earnings happening. And but for crypto, the lack of that fundamental anchor is what stops many people from investing, because they say today it's here, tomorrow who knows. And do you think about that? Is that a factor?
I'll give you a counterpoint. Do you believe the DCF pricing of any of the FANG stocks makes any sense, and it comes to it, and it's currently trading at a fundamental value?
No, I mean, I don't believe that. I don't put my money in FANG. I just I very much know that if I want to invest, you know, system, like discretionarily, I have to spend more time than I have. But I mean, if you go stocks, at least for bonds, there's some sort of anchor, right? And even stocks, I wouldn't say perfect, but like vaguely at least correlated to a company's future in the long term.
I think that there is a story that can be sold. And using this pricing model tells a story. Because it may not revert to that level ever. It might take 5 years, 10 years. I mean, if you talk about the horizon of value investors like Buffett, I mean, it's in decades, measured in decades. We don't live, I mean, I don't know. We all have career risk. I mean, so even if you're a value PM doing equity, not sure you have a decade before your boss comes and taps you on the shoulder for underperformance. No, I mean, it's real. The fact is, there are some tokens and projects and things that will provide a value. Networks always have some kind of intrinsic value to proportional, right? Metcalfe's law to the proportionality of the people that are using them. Is that worth what it's trading at? Probably not. Does that mean that there's a floor there? Maybe. For things that are still proof of work, the cost of doing that work is a fundamental cost. So you cannot produce one Bitcoin less than the cost of the energy to produce said Bitcoin. So there must be a floor somewhere between the cost of production and the cost of the network. Proof of stake would be what would be the baseline return that I could get for, say, staking this ETH and supporting the network versus taking it out and putting it in fixed income. So that's still like 4.5 or 5%.
Yeah. I mean,
which is and it's about there. 3 to 5% is the staking for ETH. So you do see that this level of returns or level a baseline level is starting to arrive in crypto. I think it's becoming a lot more fleshed out, but because it's so young, there are no white papers that give you a pricing model, so you can't study it. You can't study and be like, yeah, this is the model I'm using. Everyone accepts this baseline model. There's no Black-Scholes accepted level model or DCF accepted level model for crypto that allows everyone to agree this is the floor, and then we'll play. And that goes back, if everyone thinks that this is the floor, it becomes the floor, right? Self-fulfilling prophecy. That doesn't exist in crypto, so you don't have that feeling. But in equities, you probably would. If people had equity that was trading less than DCF, people will come in and step in. And enough people will step in that it goes back to DCF, right? So is that mean that the value was really the DCF value? I'm not sure.
Okay, fair, yeah. You know, younger people entering finance today, they're entering a completely different world, right? Like nobody, I mean, in the sense that hiring is a lot, you know, both easier and harder. The sort of work they're doing is completely different. What advice do you have to young people entering finance?
Well, finance is really ephemeral. There are a lot of jobs in it, and a lot of them is meaningless, I guess. I think there's a book called BS Jobs, and I think finance definitely comes into that. So you need to be able to deliver tangible value and get meaning from that for yourself. I know I'm pushing numbers around on these computers every day, but I get so much joy from playing the game. I get so much joy from like being able to extract return from the market when most people can't, and knowing that I'm playing a negative sum game and someone else is trying to take an edge on me. That dollar I earned, that point I got in this game was hard earned and someone was fighting me for it and they lost and I won. I know that's a very cocky, arrogant way to think about it, but that's how I think about it. And that's what keeps driving me. This ability to keep playing and to keep doing this thing I enjoy. It's just a huge intellectual challenge that I chose. I chose my problem. I chose these types of problems I want to work on. I didn't have to work on these types of problems. I like wearing risk. I like playing cards. I used to play a lot of cards, and that kind of, I guess, showed that I had that. I don't know. But that is the first step. I don't think following your passion is a thing. Passion is not enough. That is just going to like get you there for the 1 or 2 years and you're going to burn out. You need to like have it as part of your core value. Something less fluffy and hand wavy would be improve your communication. Like I was saying, we can always pull all these things that we talked about that are almost entire conversation to narrative, right? It's narrative building, the tools to create a narrative. Complex adaptive systems gave me a way to explain these very odd behaviors in a way that makes sense to people. Like, we know things go viral. Why can't other things go viral? And just what virality means in the equities world is means it's shooting up or shooting down, right? Easy. That ability to distill down these complex ideas and give example stories will take you really, really far. And you need to make sure that your CV has a reasonable story. You are crafting your story. Each job you go to is a chapter. You want to show something, how you generated the value and how that made you better so that the next chapter is even better.
Yeah, and no, that's very good advice. I spoke to someone else on the podcast and I asked them, you know, the same question, and they said, oh, just don't go to finance. which I found really funny, but thanks for that answer. There's this among many of my peers, there's the question of, should I spend my time, computer science, how much technical skills should I know? Because many of the people who are trying to finance, like on the not quant side, are people who like to do, you know, finance in college. And now there's one thing, like, you know, should I take a CS minor? What should I do? What's your thinking behind that for people just starting in?
You better know how to code. Mm. That is table stakes these days. If you can't code in Python, then you're not going to be looked at all.
Okay.
Excel VBA is 20 years old by now. We can get over that. So I don't think you need to necessarily take a CS minor if you learn to code on the side. But like, there's so many free resources for you to know how to code Python. If you don't know how to code Python, I think that's the new Excel.
Okay.
So consider that if that's the new Excel, because we have so much more data now, Excel can't process it. It was the same like before. The people who could not use MS Office, you would actually put that on your CV at the bottom. Like, I can use MS Office. Like, yeah, then it becomes normal.
Maybe it's just a matter of my age, but were there actually people who could not use MS Office? Because it's quite, I mean, I've grown up using it.
Yeah, man. It was a thing. It was a skill. It's upskill. Like, people before still use calculators and like graph paper.
Oh,
my God.
Okay.
So, no, but it's like that. We are going through one of these phases again. Mm. Right, the world goes through these technological changes, and where high end skills before become basic, and the people who do the basic skills get lower pay. You need to be able to do the par, and other technical skills. Math is always good, so if you have like some kind of STEM background, I think it's good. Okay, if you're studying finance, you take a math or stats or some kind of thing, because the relationships are getting much more complicated, and math is the language of relationships. So like, if you are able to quantify these things and find things, I mean, that has been my take. I mean, I'm sure that there are people out there who are able to read all of the company's earnings reports and like get something out of that, but I'm not one of those people. I am, in fact, the only person, or okay, my team are the only people in our company who don't have CFA. So like, we are completely talking other languages. I do believe, though, that having some basic foundation in there so that you could read the white papers that are coming out, like SSRN is such a great resource. You can see all the good quant research coming out of universities. You should just be on top of what other people are doing just to know what the other participants in the market are looking at. You don't have to be able to do anything about it, but maybe you'll stumble upon something that you can. And the more experience in the market you get, you'll see which ones actually have a seed of a good idea and which ones are junk. And then you're like, hey, actually, I could replicate that one in Google Sheets. There are some out there that you could. Mm-hmm. And then if you know Python, almost everything that you find in SSRN or any of the journals will be replicatable to you. So it just opens up your world. Like, you're able to backtest these things for yourself. You're able to like confirm, is this author BS or not? Did they like cherry pick this time frame because they need a good p-value or not? And then it just opens so many doors.
Right. Okay. So do you read academic research like actively?
All the time.
Okay. Because I mean, I guess the different, because you're quant, but like all the other fundamental, like, you know, discussing finance people told me to, they, I mean, they said like they've never opened a journal in since college.
No, I mean, this fragility thing comes from, the seed is from a journal and what I saw some banks were doing.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, you need to come with a hypothesis, and that hypothesis comes from market experience. Mm-hmm. I know that these situations exist. Why are these regime changes happening? Why is the market fragile now and not fragile now? How do I identify this thing? That is something a discretionary person would be trying to figure out. But mm-hmm. they would just be reading the news to figure out if it's happening. Like, why can't I read the news and do mm-hmm. this analysis? Mm-hmm. Like, there is no downside except losing time. And you, as a young guy, have a lot of time. I guess so.
Everyone tells me that, but it feels hard to believe it.
I would say maybe. When you first start out, it's hard to believe it, or it's hard to believe it if you have been brainwashed by the TradFi education system. If you really do believe in efficient markets hypothesis, if you really believe that DCF is going to give you the true value of something, if you believe those things, then these this like empirical study of the markets is not going to fit you. If you believe in the scientific method, then this is going to fit you great, because you can test everything and you can prove to yourself if it did or didn't, and you ran the experiment. So the only person you're lying to would be yourself. And so just creating a discipline, a rigorous way of research, you can convince yourself that your research process is good. If the process is good, then the output is good. And then don't take whether or not the end result was profitable or not profitable, or you weren't able to prove it or not, as the result. Good research process, then whatever that answer is what the answer is. And that, I think, is a different switch than me believing I'm smarter than the market. Discretionary people need to be smarter than the market, because your expectation has to be different than the market for me able to get an edge. If you have the market consensus view, you have no alpha, because you're already priced in. It's like, it doesn't even make any sense. So how are you going to be so much smarter than the collective herd of Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, bulge bracket banks, your Citadels, your Renaissance, all of these guys? You're telling me you are going to be smarter. I'm not that arrogant.
I mean, in many ways, a market position is an act of great confidence, which is, you know, probably not. There's this famous paper which asks, why do we have so many trades? Because, like, if you say that, if people were to rationally assume that the market knows better than they do, we'd have, you know, very few. And the fact that we have so many implies that most people are unjustifiably overconfident.
Oh, I 100% agree with that. It's hard to be intellectually humble. And it's hard to admit that you're wrong. These are the two things that are really required. Like, and it goes back to that psychological aspect. You have to be able to say you're wrong quickly, but you have to be confident when you put on the trade, right? So I have to be like weakly confident. I don't know how to put it. It's like, when I did it, I know I have my research. Whatever way you did it, I'm putting this trade on. I believe that there is X amount of spread that I can capture, or there is some profit margin or whatever. I'm going to put it on. And then I'm going to constantly be looking for ways to invalidate my hypothesis. And most people do the reverse. They want confirmation bias. They want to say, this news is positive for everything. No, I do the complete opposite. I know my brain is going to be looking for those good new articles that make me feel good, so I can just leave that to the side. I'm going to try to look for things that are going to blow it up. And if I can find those things and invalidate my hypothesis, that's the mental load that I should be doing. And if whatever my hypothesis invalidate, just cut the trade. Set your stop loss, cut the trade, just do it. And then do that over and over and over again. And your tools will be better, your mental will be better, and hopefully your trades will be better.
No, that's good. We're sadly hitting the end of our time here. So thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure. Yep.